Good morning. Climate is changing, and climate change is having impacts on the waters of the United States. Next slide, please. Do we have an advantage? You can be advancing. These are the questions, and to boil them down, there's really two questions. One is, what the heck is going on? And then the bottom two questions can be boiled down to, what are we going to do about it? Next, please. I'm going to focus on the what's going on question in terms of three issues: sea level rise, snowpack loss, and the geographical redistribution of water resources. Next. We're going to start with sea level rise. Next. In the last century, sea level rose about 6 inches. In the last decade of the last century, that rise rate accelerated to about 1 foot per century. And projections for the coming century are for anywhere from 0.5 foot to 2 feet of sea level rise. That's where most of the estimates fall. Next. What are the consequences of sea level rise specifically for water supply? The main consequence is increased risk of saltwater contamination of coastal water supplies, whether they be derived from surface water sources or groundwater resources. And one of our other speakers is going to develop this concept a little more detail, so I'm going to move right on to my second issue. Next, please. Which is that of snowpack loss. Next. We're going to focus on California because that is where we expect the largest, earliest manifestations of snowpack loss. We're going to look at a USGS stream gauge site on the Merced River up in the Sierra Nevada. This is the gauge at Happy Isles Bridge. Next, please. The Sierra Nevada and California get their precipitation in the form of snow, mainly, and much of it falls in the Sierra Nevada, where it forms the snowpack in winter. Next slide. In the springtime, the air starts warming up, the sun is higher in the sky, and we have snow melt. That drives runoff into the rivers, which come down into the Central Valley. And on average, it takes about 4 months from the time that that water falls as snow until it comes down out of the hills to the valley as runoff. Next slide, please. That water is coming just in time. That 4 month delay is a great thing because late spring, early summer is when agriculture is spinning up. You're irrigating your fields, getting ready for the growing season. And also the seasonal demand from urban populations is spinning up around then too. So this delay of the runoff by the snowpack is a great thing. What's been happening in recent years and is projected to continue as we go forward is an increasing amount of precipitation is falling not as snow, but as rainfall instead. Next slide. So the consequences of this loss of snowpack are really the loss of some environmental services that the snowpack provides, and I'll mention three of them. One is the loss of a natural flood control system, because when precipitation arrives as rain, it's much easier to produce a flood than when it comes down the hills as snowmelt. Secondly, we have a loss of that reservoir, that time delay mechanism that helps us to balance the seasonal supply and demand for water in California. And finally, as the snowpack dries out, melts earlier in the year, the mountain environment dries out earlier in the year, and in general, we have a tendency toward increased risk for fire. So we lose the fire suppression effect of the snowpack. Next, please. We're moving along here. I'm going to focus most on this third issue, and this is an issue that I think has received the least attention, but has potential to have some of the greatest impacts in the long run, and that's why I'm going to spend a little extra time on it. Next, please. And in fact, before I show you any model projections, I'm going to ask the question that half of you probably would shoot your hands up and ask anyway, which is, why should we believe these models? Is there any credibility to them? And so I'm going to spend a good digression here addressing that question. Next, please. So we've gone and collected stream flow data, including USGS, but from national hydrologic services around the world, and analyze those data to try to put together a picture of what are the regional patterns of ups and downs during the 20th century in stream flow and hence in water availability. Where did it get wetter? The blue circles. Where did it get drier? The red circles. And the long-term trends. I mean, we all know there's plenty of ups and downs, but there's some long-term trends. Those have a component of natural variability, but there's a hypothesis that they also have a component that's driven by changes in climate forcing mechanisms, be they natural or anthropogenic. What we did was to basically go to the climate modelers and say, you know, if you're so smart, if you can tell us what's going to happen in the 21st century, prove it. You know, go back to the 20th century. We're not going to tell you what we got from our stream flow analysis, but you tell us out of your models what the runoff changes are. We'll analyze that, turn it into stream flows, and make a similar comparison to what we did with the OBS. So that's the comparison I'm going to show you. Next slide, please. On the top, again, is the observations. On the bottom, I'm going to show you what picture the models taken together in sort of a boiled down into a single result, what they projected retrospectively for the 20th century. Now, what's making things change in the 20th century in a climate model? What's making things change is the changes in CO2 that are put into the model, the changes, the volcanic eruptions and so forth, things that we know happened that affect climate. Solar variability, it's in there. All of those natural effects and anthropogenic effects are in the models. Tell the climate modelers, okay, what's your picture? And I'm going to reveal that picture now. First slide, South America. And we're going to work our way around the globe here clockwise. So let's go to the next one, North America, and then on to Eurasia, Europe and Asia, and finally to Africa and Australia. There's a pretty good agreement between those two pictures, subjectively. What about objectively? What can we say? Well, there's a lot of dull and boring statistics, technical analysis we can do, but I'd like to boil down all the results of that into one basic statement, which is that the degree of agreement between these two maps is substantially larger than could possibly have occurred by chance. It is indicative of skill. It is indicative of ability of the models to give us information about hydroclimatic change, about water availability change. We're moving beyond temperature here. We're talking about water. Now, I don't want to, you know, overdo this. Models are not perfect. Models are far from perfect. They need a lot more work. The glass is not empty, but neither is the glass full. Okay? I don't know how full it is. It's somewhere in between. And whatever's in that glass, I think, is useful. It's useful to water managers, can help satisfy their thirst for information about water, information they need to manage that resource. Next slide, please. So given that background, I've asserted that climate models have some skill, and now I may put up for you a picture that shows the projections of those models for about the middle of this century, 2050. The picture is colored in many places. Where it's not colored is points where the models had a lower degree of agreement. Basically, we used 12 different climate models. If 8 or more of them agreed, we went ahead and colored a country or a state. If 11 or 12 of them agreed, we put some diagonal hatching in there, okay? The colors give you the amounts, 5, 10, 20, 40% changes. Oranges and browns are decreases. The blues are increases. Where are the drying spots? Northeastern South America, Southern Africa, Southeast Australia. The Amazon region, don't quote me on that. The Mediterranean region, that's Northern Africa, Southern Europe, the Middle East, and on eastward. And finally, and let's go to the next slide for a zoom in on the USA, averages by state. Finally, the Western Mountain region, and in particular the Southwest, increases 20 to 40%, 10 to 20%, decreases in water availability. And in Alaska, a great big whopping increase that's robust across models. Next slide, please. Yeah, what are the consequences of these projections for practical matters, for water availability? Here are three of them. The first is the most obvious. There's a changing risk, and in the Southwest, that's an increasing risk of a probability of failing to meet water demands. Decreasing probability of failure in the Midwest. There's always an up and a down. The second point here is changing risk of floods. Probably a tendency toward increased risk of floods in the Midwest, decreased risk in the Southwest. Although, we're just talking about that geographical redistribution issue here, you got on top of that the loss of snowpack, and that's going to cut the other way in the West. And then changing risk of droughts, which is one of the serious concerns here for the Southwest and the Mountain West. Next, please. So I come back to this slide I showed early on. I've talked about what's going on, the first two slides, and now I want to talk briefly before I finish here about what we can do about it, and specifically what can science contribute to society's decisions about what we do about it. Next, please. The two big buzzwords in what we're going to do about it are mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation means doing all those things you hear about, you know, getting rid of your SUV and then power plants, all that business, all those things that are trying to avoid climate change. The message, which I try to boil down in this picture, is that mitigation can have an enormous effect on potential impacts in the latter half of the 21st century. But there are some time delays just built into a number of systems which mean that we can only make a dent by means of mitigation in the first half of this century. What does that leave? That leaves the other buzzword, adaptation. Adaptation means climate change, it's in the pipeline, it's real, deal with it. It's unavoidable. So adaptation is what we want to focus on and is going to be a major customer, I think, for science information about water. Next slide, please. You know, you can list all the possible things from which water users can decide on how they may adapt, and I won't read them off the slide here, but the main point I want to make is that these are decisions that I don't make, the USGS doesn't make. The public makes these decisions, and they need information in order to make those decisions. Next, please. But when we talk about information, we got to keep in mind this real dilemma that's being faced by all of us, and that is there's always value in making a decision as soon as possible in order to minimize effects of a change, but on the other hand, the knowledge base is evolving really rapidly, so you feel like, I'd just like to wait until tomorrow or next year to make this decision. And I think every decision, you have to balance the value of waiting. And, you know, there's no simple solution to that. Fortunately, citizens in general and water managers in particular are no strangers to the practice of making decisions under uncertainty, but they just need that information. Next, please. So, and this is my final slide, what are some of the things that we can do? What kinds of information can we provide? We can identify and quantify the vulnerabilities, and in fact, that's sort of what I've been trying to do in the first part of this talk. Moving forward, though, we need a lot more detail in the pictures, and that's why we will continue with the kinds of work that we do, monitoring the environment, trying to model that, and doing research so that we can build the models and put all that together into an understandable picture. And then on top of that, and not just a tack on, something we've got to really internalize as part of the process is communication. We need to greatly crank up the rate of communication because things are changing and they're changing quickly and our knowledge of them is changing quickly. So I used the analogy, the metaphor before of a glass of water, and you know, one could argue, some people would argue that yeah, we've got some water, but you know, it's even worse than that. We don't have the glass to deliver it to the thirsty water manager. We're delivering it with an eyedropper. What we need to do is think real hard about how can we very efficiently and very quickly get information through the system, from the basic science right through to the water user. And with that, I'll close my remarks. And as Bob mentioned, we'll be taking questions later. Thank you.